Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. We've traveled to New York City to take part in Climate Week conversations. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
Our guest in this episode of Path to Zero is an award-winning journalist at HuffPost, Alexander Kaufman. In his reporting, Alexander explores the energy transition and the contentious debates occurring around climate change.
So, Alexander, thanks so much for stopping by and welcome to Path to Zero.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote a kind of really interesting piece about Ukraine and kind of the impact of that particular nuclear plant during this war with Russia. Do you think that, I mean, I feel like we're at a point where Chernobyl is behind us, Fukushima is kind of behind us, you see the Japanese maybe making, you know, little steps back towards nuclear. Do you think this Ukraine nuclear plant will impact nuclear growth in the future?
So I think it's impossible to game out what a radiation disaster would do, because it's impossible to know exactly how severe a radiation disaster caused by some type of artillery shelling might be. You know, I mean, in Zaporizhia, if I'm pronouncing that right, you know, there are many protections that certainly were not there for Chernobyl. You know, Chernobyl is probably a less relevant analogy than Fukushima, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And with Fukushima, you know, I think that there were a lot of lessons learned by the broader community about what that meant. You know, I always like to ask people how many deaths they think were caused by radiation from Fukushima. And most people kind of scratch their heads and guess a lot, you know, at least several dozen. And the answer is one. You know, one person died, a worker, you know, who got lung cancer that they traced back to his radiation exposure years later. I think he died in 2018. Now, there were, on the contrary, about 700 or so people that some Japanese newspapers tallied as having died in the stress and the chaos of the evacuation. But from the actual radiation, only one. It was actually, in many ways, kind of a success story in terms of containing a disaster that was caused, as you know, research later showed, by a failure to, you know, meet certain regulations, to, you know, skirt new rules on safety. They were ill prepared, but, you know, I think there were a lot of people, while the initial reaction to that was to think that nuclear power was just too safe to even continue using existing reactors, that over time people began to understand that, you know, perhaps that was a bit of an overreaction, and perhaps, you know, we need to look at this again. And what I found from talking to some people and reporting that piece is that while, you know, I think the initial thought is that, you know, any kind of radiation disaster is going to scare people again and make people realize the stakes of this, you know, I think public attitudes are beginning to change a lot. One, you know, you have a lot more people who are voting adults and, you know, parents of children now who grew up without the fear of nuclear annihilation of the Cold War. You know, I was born in 1991, an end of history kid. And so that concept of needing to go under my desk because the Soviets might, you know, unleash nuclear annihilation on us is not part of my life. You know, certainly I think more people are more concerned about climate change now, and it's really hard to come up with something that is more energy dense and has no CO2. And I think now, in the wake of the Ukraine war, offers a sense of energy sovereignty that is very hard to come by, and that I think people are very aware of, whether it is because they understand how natural gas supply chains work and who benefits from them, or frankly, if they are thinking about renewables, how dependent the US is on China for not just the completed products, but, you know, the dominant share of processed lithium, you know, of processed rare earths and all of these other commodities that are necessary to making that happen. And so, you know, I guess there are some people who are attracted to the idea that the answer then is we have to dramatically scale down and, you know, the pandemic era lockdowns are somehow a model for how we should reconfigure society. You know, while those I guess, are some louder voices on the political left. There's certainly an academic movement behind some of that. I have not seen any evidence that there could be any type of serious democratic support for doing something like that. And so then is the question, we're going to get rid of democracy? You know, because many of these same people that seem to be advocating that worldview are also quite concerned about threats to democracy. So that doesn't seem to be something that they are latching onto. So then what? You know, it seems to me, at least in its present form, to be a big distraction from getting at some of the more complex and tougher questions that tend to blur ideological lines, partisan lines, and in that I actually see some hope in that, you know, you don't have the complete culture warization of these issues, and regardless of which party is in power of Congress after this election, that you might be able to see some serious progress on these things.
Yeah, you'd like to think these issues transcend politics. So, I mean, you just said three or four lovely things in there that you don't want to go back, because you use the word energy density. That's the point where I always come back, is solar and wind, and maybe offshore wind a little bit better about energy density, but we just, you cannot replace a massive nuclear plant with solar panels. I mean, or if you do, it's certainly at the expense of the landscape and sometimes, you know, properties, whatever.
Sure. I mean, look, I don't know the exact estimate, but just how much of New York State would need to be covered in solar panels to just compensate on a capacity level for the loss of Indian Point is one thing, to say nothing of, you know, all the backup and other things that you would need to make up for the fact that that is not a 24-hour source of generation, right? To say nothing of the fact that those solar panels are going to have to be replaced in, what, at least 30 years? Right? You know, not the same type of lifespan that you have from that the asset of a fission reactor. And then beyond that, you know, those solar panels will need to be backed up with gas or something else right now. In the meantime, since there was no plan for doing anything like that, when they shut down Indian Point, they replaced it completely with fossil fuels. And, you know, while I think that there are important debates to be had over, you know, I don't think fossil fuels is you know, one thing that behaves the same way. Obviously, there are different parts to that, but the increase in local PM2.5 that we will see from the increased burning of different fuels at the expense of not having this nuclear plant anymore will have health effects on people.
Right.
There's no question about that. As far as anyone I've spoken to, there is no one who can explain to me how what we understand about how PM2.5 works won't lead to shortened lives of New Yorkers because we shut this down. So we lost this nuclear generating plant because of some theoretical risk that it posed, and imposed on New Yorkers real health risks, not just risks, but actual health consequences that are going to come from that. And that contradiction is not something I've seen widely addressed, and, you know, frustrates me greatly, because you don't have any kind of real accountability for that outcome.
Have you been able to write about that?
I've written quite a bit about, you know, New York's energy issues and the effects of Indian Point. I've written about it primarily in the context of the fight that blossomed after its closure over the Hydro-Quebec transmission line project to carry, you know, power down from you know, Quebec's 100% renewable hydro grid into New York City. You know, the completion of that project, which, as opposed to many other projects, was permitted, had all of its materials bought already pre-inflation, so, you know, won't have the extra expense of any new project needing to go out and buy all of that steel and other equipment. And, you know, that this project was supposed to make up for at least 50% of the lost capacity that we had from closing Indian Point. So building it only gets us 50% of the way back to the slightly cleaner grid that we had before. And so I've explained these things in that context, in the context too of the same environmental groups that crusaded for the closure of Indian Point, went on and in at least one prominent case, flipped their support for this transmission project from a yes when it was useful for advocating the closure of the nuclear plant to a no afterward when they had determined that actually this was blood energy because of historical grievances from a very small handful of indigenous groups in Quebec, or concern over the Hudson, you know, the pristine body of water that we know that to be. And I was able to communicate some of those things in that story, yeah.
You just again said three or four things, but I want to go back because I don't hear very many people talk about it. I'd say often people are technologists, this is what we can do. Sometimes they're economists, which again, I like to talk about being able to afford it, but I'm always on record as saying I never want to talk about climate without talking about health. And frankly, I want to talk about climate and health and then equity, right? So it's about, is this good in terms of carbon? But more importantly, which is what you're saying, is it good for our human health? To go from nuclear to burning coal and wood, talk about PM2.5, it's horrific for our health. And I know you lived in California sometime. 75% of the children in the LA basin are impacted in some way by asthma, bronchitis, and as they grow up to be adults, it becomes COPD. It's horrific, and it's here now, right? Climate, you can at least argue climate is not here now. It's coming fast, and it soon will be here, but health is here now. Mm-hmm. And so I read very rarely people talking, you know, emphasis on health.
Well, you know, I think there have been people talking about this for a long time, but I think one piece worth reading on this is by the writer David Wallace Wells, now at the New York Times, who wrote a piece for the London Review of Books, I think late last year, about local air pollution and PM2.5 being a much more useful and tangible thing to point to for the climate movement, to ordinary people to get a better understanding of what the risks are to themselves and in their lives. And you know, he was zeroing in particular on many of these states out west who now are just routinely being showered in particles from these wildfires. And you know, I mean, I felt that essay very acutely when, you know, one of my best friends from growing up moved out to Boulder, Colorado, just outside Boulder, at the beginning of 2020. He's a big hiker. He and his wife are big outdoors people, and it was just a perfect adventure. You know, he loves the mountains. It's amazing to them. But you know, he called me one of these days, I think last winter, when that fire was raging into Boulder, and it only stopped about a mile from his house. And he had been watching it, deciding what to do, and when suddenly he started smelling this foul, acrid scent of burning plastic and other chemicals in the air, he realized, oh shoot, you know, I better get out of here. And had to pack up his things and decide which of his belongings, of him and his wife, you know, his wife works in a hospital, she was busy at the time, you know, he was going to take with him. And it was just an experience that I haven't had, but reminds me in some ways of the stories I hear from, you know, my grandparents or other people, you know, in my temple about what it was like to flee, you know, different kinds of persecution in Europe at various times and have to decide as you run for your life what you're actually going to take with you. And that kind of issue, you know, the long-term health effects of whatever it is he's breathing and the risk that, you know, his home may incinerate at any given time is something that I struggle to, you know, really grapple with, and I think many, many more people are going to struggle to grapple with that in years to come.
I think that's why you're an award-winning journalist sometimes, because you're able to humanize some of those issues, which, you know, as a reader, it's beyond technical, it's about lives in general. So let's pick up a few things. You've written so many neat articles, you've traveled all over the world. Maybe what's the most interesting story you've covered, and perhaps why?
The most interesting story I've covered. I don't know that I could choose just one, but you know, I will say, since we were discussing the nuclear issue earlier, that I really, I was fascinated earlier this year to go to Finland for the first time and to visit the Olkiluoto plant, which you know, while there. Yeah, there were sort of three major projects that exemplified the struggles to build new traditional nuclear reactors. One is the Vogtle plant in Georgia, the other is the Sizewell plant in the UK, and then there was this Olkiluoto plant. And when they completed this in March, it became the first new nuclear reactor to come online in Western Europe in 15 years. 25 years if you don't count the Czech Republic as part of Western Europe. And so, yeah, it was a huge deal. And making it even more monumental is that about a mile down the road, they are digging thousands of feet into the earth, into bedrock that hasn't moved in a couple billion years, and creating the world's first permanent repository for spent fuel waste. And so getting to see that and getting to visit there and getting to understand their perspective on energy was really meaningful to me, in part because, you know, I have covered these issues for a while in the U.S. primarily, although, you know, I have been to other countries. And, you know, in the U.S., there has been a dominant view against nuclear, I think, in a lot of the environmental movement and from many of the NGOs that I've frequently spoken to as sources and stories. And going to Finland and seeing how overwhelmingly the public supports this, and Greenpeace in Finland supports nuclear, the Green Party in Finland supports nuclear. That really, you know, helped me to get a better understanding of these things and helped me to, I think, understand how some of the dogma around certain energy issues is quite confined to specific countries. And, you know, made me feel that there is a certain chauvinism from Americans who think that none of this stuff should exist anywhere, where, like, what are you going to do? Tell the Finns that their country that's dark 6 months of the year has to run completely on solar? You know, it's a ludicrous proposition.
Vast differences in how energy is created around the world, how it's used, when it's used, the growth rates that necessitate the future. You talk a lot about the electric grid, and we talk about climate. One of the things I think shocks me is, as we study it, again, not studying it to see necessarily how we fit, studying it in general, is that the electric grid today in the U.S., we think it's dirty, but when we kind of break it into climate intensity, it's filthy. And we just finished a study where we looked at 7 or 8 of the balancing authorities, Texas, for example. And you take all of the inputs and turn it into carbon intensity, significantly dirtier than natural gas and propane, which really surprised me because lots of wind, lots of solar in that Texas grid. But all the grids we looked at, the California grid, the New York grid, you talked about, you know, MISO, is that how you say it? Mm-hmm. All of those grids, now the Pacific Northwest, a little bit different. But all of those grids were dirtier today in carbon than natural gas or propane. Does that surprise you as a person who reports on this every day?
Well, no. I think that there are, you know, you have many different sources of generation in these grids. You know, you still have coal as a major part of those grids. And I think people forget that a lot of the backup power, even in a place that most people, I guess, would think of as very progressive or forward-thinking on climate, like New York City, can at times be things like fuel oil, you know? Number 5 fuel oil
is at times.
Is at times what runs the peaker plants that surround my neighborhood in Astoria, Queens.
So that's the second piece that we've started, again, just trying to understand, is not looking at the base inputs, but begin to looking at the incremental inputs of the next. So as the grid grows, or we drop off power sources, either one, you have to replace it with the next available technology. And as you say, quite often the next available technology is something that's not as clean as the available technology. And so we begin to see how not only the grid is dirty today and hopefully getting cleaner, but the incremental growth in the grid is pretty filthy. So I don't see anybody writing about a migration to electric-powered things may not be as clean as the fuel they're replacing.
Well, sure. I mean, electrification, I think, definitely has been dogged by the issues that the grid itself, you know, it is not necessarily clean. I guess the counter to that that I have heard from people who studied this is that electric appliances, this is not true of all electric appliances, electric boilers, for instance, are highly inefficient, but, you know, that certain heat pumps and other electric devices are more efficient overall in energy use, so you're seeing a reduction in energy use. You know, I don't know how the one-to-one emissions compare, you know, when you're looking at, you know, what the emissions intensity of the grid that's powering that device is versus, you know, the fuels that may have powered the older version of it. But, you know, I think that the bigger question for me is actually the grid's ability to take on all of that additional demand.
You know, just the supply.
We've lived in an era where, you know, efficiency gains have more or less kept demand at a flat level for a long time. And I think there was a wrong assumption that that would just continue. And now between, you know, we have the increased demand for electricity from electrification, we have the increased demand for electricity, potentially for things like green hydrogen production. We have increased demand of electricity for things perhaps like desalination plants out west, if that is the solution that we're going to go for, to say nothing of the energy intensity of direct air capture, which I realize is something that, you know, some environmentalists oppose for moral hazard reasons, but I haven't seen many other better solutions because planting trees is not going to get us where we need to be on the carbon ban. And then that's not even thinking about the things that are unrelated to climate change, like crypto mining, which, you know, I'm not going to say whether that's good or bad, but it's real. And I don't know that we can live in a world where the idea is that if some type of economic activity that people want to participate in, you know, requires too much energy, that we just shut down everything like that. That's not the kind of country that we live in. So that to me suggests that we need to come up with a lot of ways to create vast energy abundance, and that needs to be a major focus of policy right now to both avoid blackouts and all the horrors that come with that. I mean, there are millions of people in Puerto Rico right now without electricity. Those are Americans that we can't provide the basic necessities of modern life to. So that needs to be addressed. And, you know, I think that over time, obviously the emissions intensity of existing grids and everything needs to be that needs to be addressed in probably in the short term in order to make sure that we can hit our climate goals.
This, you went through a laundry list of great things. I'm going to add one thing to that, and that is the replacement of direct fired appliances, natural gas, propane, water heaters, furnaces, and substituting electric, which some are efficient, some are not, but it's not a one-to-one.
Right,
and direct use versus not to create electricity, transport it. We see a lot of times it's takes twice as much energy. And even to the heat pumps, as you talk about, heat pumps are very efficient at 50, 60, 70 degrees. They're not very efficient at 0 degrees. Temperatures you see here regularly, 0, plus 10, minus 10 in Boston. So it's so much. And this, I don't see the writing about it, and my perception is when you do write about it, people don't want to read that. I don't know if it's true or not, but
you know, I'm not sure. I mean, this I think is one of the more complex issues around around climate. You know, it deals with people's personal lives in a much more tangible way. And you know, I think again that there is a lot of variation across the board, right? I mean, I think electrification of vehicles is a pretty straightforward climate benefit. You know, I think that there are strong cases to be made about you know, the health benefits of, you know, the electrification of certain appliances. You know, I've also understood, you know, certain types of fuels to operate very differently from other types of fuels. That propane and natural gas, you know, aren't necessarily just a purple and a green grape in
right.
a bunch.
Going right? back to your PM 2.5, comparing it to diesel fuel or coal,
right?
Nowhere. Yeah. And I know for us, when we look at the emissions, and again, we don't fool with consumer vehicles, mm-hmm. passenger. We may be in limousines, but mm-hmm. we really tend to be in medium duty stuff. Particulate matter is literally not able to be found. Mm-hmm. Or diesel fuels.
So, can I ask this though about natural gas, which is just, you know, the carbon intensity, I think, is one measure, but what about the methane? You know, and I understand the methane fee and other industry steps and regulations are going to hopefully help to address those issues. Certainly, it seems like the infrared sensors are helping to identify leaks more easily. But, you know, I am moved by arguments from environmentalists that say that, you know, the increase in methane emissions can be perhaps the thing that pushes us to a climate tipping point, and that is something that is hard to ignore, even if the carbon intensity is lower.
100% right. In fact, let me back up. One of the nice things about propane doesn't have methane.
Right.
You knew that.
I know, right.
I'm
saying this in reference to natural gas.
So it's funny. I've been on this for 5 years saying that the natural gas industry has to eliminate the methane leaks.
Yeah.
Just back from a natural gas conference last week where, for the first time, I heard a group of speakers, not environmentalists, these were engineers involved in the production of natural gas, talking about what they were doing to eliminate leaks. And I feel like, for the first time, they really understand that that has to be maybe their top goal, driven partly by economics now, right? They were quick to say, I don't want to leak something that I sell for $8.
Yeah.
Right? But 100% right. It really has never been about technology. It's
right.
been about the industry's willingness to find, fix, maintain those leaks.
Sure, and the economics that are set up by the regulations around them. But look, I mean, to I think your point around these things, you know, if Western Europe could stop using natural gas like that, it would have happened this year, you know? So I think there has been a really clarifying phenomenon from this war and from the effects of the war around the speed that is just possible to do certain things. And, you know, I think it has strengthened arguments, I'm not saying this is my viewpoint necessarily, but it has strengthened arguments from those that want to see more domestic production, because, you know, the alternative is what, you know, whether it's the alternative for what we're using here or the alternative for our allies that are, you know, otherwise, you know, relying on fuel that is helping to finance the largest land war in Europe since World War II.
Right. Energy independence and energy security certainly take on a new lesson, and something I think we've all known for a long time that apparently is never widely reported is the Russian method of securing natural gas or even producing LNG. It's not the same environmentally friendly way we do it here.
Sure.
It's horrible that you see some of the shortcuts they make.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, I think that a version of this debate is also happening around mining for the minerals and metals needed to produce solar panels and batteries and things like that. But, you know, I also have yearned to see, but haven't seen this as part of the broader discussions, what the, you know, what a U.S. foreign policy response needs to be in order mm-hmm. to, you know, perhaps remain a large producer while having the credibility in international negotiations to persuade certain countries to avoid their emissions.
We're going to take a hard turn here for a second. I want to call out a book that you wrote recently, just out, right? Earth's Aquarium. Tell us about how that book came to be and kind of what you're doing with it.
So, you know, I have always appreciated nature, and particularly aquatic nature. I grew up on Long Island by the water. You know, being at the beach was a big part of my life always. And seeing the destruction of some really beautiful ecosystems there too was part of my life. You know, the beautiful salt marshes that were being developed into housing and other things. Not that I oppose developing housing, but, you know, this was not dense housing to alleviate the housing crisis. It's luxury housing. And, you know, in 2018, I was lucky enough to do a National Press Foundation Fellowship in Tampa that was focused on sustainable fisheries. Got to do some just nice, fun stuff, go out fishing on the Gulf for the first time, which was a lot of fun, a lot of like group things, which was nice. And eat some really, you know, delicious seafood down there and just learn about how the industry there was adapting to, you know, different issues in their fisheries, you know, not just from the BP spill, but, you know, just from overfishing or from the warming of the water down there, just changing which types of species were living there. So that was an issue I was really interested in, and I never gave much thought to writing a children's book of any kind, but a publisher in London reached out to me, having seen that I had done this fellowship and that I had done, you know, some various stories on the fishing industry and how fisheries were being affected by climate change, and asked me if I would consider doing something like this. And at first, I wasn't really interested. You know, I don't have kids yet, so it's not as near and dear to my heart. And, you know, I guess I felt a little bit shy, as a lot of my friends or colleagues were writing very serious nonfiction books. And, you know, that, I don't know, maybe there was something trivial about this. And then I talked to my little niece. My niece Vivian is only a few years old, and, you know, she just loves nature and is really excited by different things that she watches on it. And I saw the illustrations from Ms. Rodriguez, and I was just blown away by her artwork, that this wasn't some kind of dinky two-dimensional cartoon drawing, but stuff that was really just beautiful art. And so I said, why not? And it turned out that a couple months after I agreed to do it, that the whole world went into lockdown and I suddenly had a lot more free time in my apartment. So it was a nice reprieve from the day-to-day chaos and fear of the early days of the pandemic to sort of lose myself in research about different aquatic ecosystems, and certainly about the threats that they face, but moreover about, you know, the beautiful and amazing networks of life that live there.
Amazing. So again, the book, Earth's Aquarium, and I encourage you to at least go find that book. I encourage you to buy that book, but also it's a great place to look for some of Alexander Kaufman's other work, and just a good example of the writing style. All right, let's have a little bit of fun. A couple questions we love to ask. Sure. We use a little bit of magic. You live in a place where magic is always around. I'm going to give you the wand, and I want you to choose one thing that in the next year would have, you know, a major impact regarding climate change and sustainability. How would you use that wand?
Nuclear fusion is not only viable, but cheap and commercially deployable next year.
You'll be proud to know you're the second voter for fusion in the last couple of months.
I'm not surprised.
The team at Princeton had that exact same wish. That's awesome. All right, one other tradition we have, and a way to thank you for your time and for your energy and for spending time with us, is to plant a tree in a national forest in your name. Now, you're a classic native New Yorker, so maybe you have a place here in New York you would love to have a tree planted. Is there a place you know of?
A national forest? Can I get back to you on this? I'm actually, this weekend, I'm going to be up in the Adirondacks with a very close friend of mine, doing a little bit of backpacking and camping around some of the peaks up there. So I feel like I might have a good connection to one of those
places. We'll look forward to that. How about anything else you want to tell our listeners, something you're working on, something you're thinking about?
Sure. You know, I mean, I guess the thing I would say, you know, rather than tease out a story, is just, you know, I know I've talked a lot about, you know, some of my recent pet issues, you know, climate change and, nuclear energy and things like that. And, you know, certainly I have expressed some of my frustrations, I think, with the overall discourse around those issues, or, you know, some of the dogma from different advocacy groups. No, I'm not opposed to any of those groups, and I value a lot of the ways that they participate. You know, I am a great believer in democracy and the messy project that it is when taking on this very difficult task of decarbonization. You know, I know a lot of people become attracted to places like China for the way that an authoritarian country can implement something as difficult as decarbonization. I believe in democracy. I want to live in a place that allows people with conflicting viewpoints to express them. And I've tried always as a reporter to be open to talking to anyone and understanding those divergent viewpoints. But, you know, I do think that with all of the interest and obsession at times with issues around misinformation, you know, whether it's about elections or Russian misinformation or, frankly, the climate denial movement being fundamentally a misinformation campaign, you know, I try to urge everyone that I talk to across the political spectrum to examine the ways that, you know, misinformation or, you know, convenient narratives may really be easy to latch onto for them, and may that it may confirm some of their prior viewpoints, but to just try to interrogate those biases. I don't think that there's anything particularly special about being a journalist, but having done this as long as I have, the one thing that was always drilled into me by editors early on when I was at little local papers was to interrogate any bias. You know, there's a joke in journalism that if your mother tells you that she loves you, check. See if you can confirm. Get a second source on that. And so, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think everybody needs to think like a newspaper man, but I think a lot of issues in this country would be helped by people just taking a look at whatever it is that they feel very sure about, and just try to examine the other viewpoints on the other side. I think that would help in a lot of ways. And so I urge everyone, listeners and anyone that I talk to, just try to make that part of their habits.
I really want to thank you for spending time with us, but more importantly, thank you for the clarity in your writing and the breadth that we really have come to appreciate when we see an article with your name on it. So thanks for being with us today in New York for Climate Week and spending time with Path to Zero.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins from Climate Week in New York City. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.